7:25:19, Rabbi Yonah Reis at BMTL in Beit Shemesh. The topic of this year is transgender converts, marijuana cheesecake, and postmortem fatherhood, Beit Din issues in the modern age.
Thank you so much. Sorry for the little delay. We had a major serious... We saved the kolo. That was the bottom line. We saved the kolo. There are only a few pieces that dropped. We performed surgery. We were able successfully to save it. It doesn't look as nice, but trust me, it's hot and good, and it's on the blech out in the back. It'll be fine. No problems. Okay. Shalom. That's like a Japanese movie. I'm not going to speak a long introduction for Rav Yonah Reis, but our relationship goes back to the time that we were in Rav Yisrael Chachamim together. I wore a bright tie in his honor because Rav Yonah Reis is very bright. And from the times that we were in yeshiva together, all the way to times working with him on various issues. And the Kehillah, I've seen him work in the basin with great dedication, sensitivity, and erudition. Of course, to take over for Rav Charlap was a very big shoes to fill, and that he did it with finesse and panache and all the different things that was very, very hard to take over someone who's been there for 30. He did it with great flair. But when the Kehillah knows of a great man, you can't keep a great man down. So he went, of course, now to be the Av Beis in Chicago, the CRC. And we have the schus tonight of hearing shir from him. And I want to thank our sponsors, Mrs. Marion Reis and family, in commemoration of the yahrzeit of Harry Reis, Harry Reis's father, and the husband of Marion, and the father of Linda Licky, and Wendy Schindler, right? Yeah, right. Okay. And she's a Facebook friend of mine. And of course, this is also in memory of the yahrzeit of Marion, Mrs. Reis's mother, Gilda Halpern, Zichrono Lecha, which was on Kaf Zayin Tammuz, and Harry Reis's Zal's yahrzeit is on Kaf Chen. And without further ado, I'd like to thank Harry Reis and Tenu Kavod Torah, Rabbi Marion Reis.
Perfect. Okay, good evening. Decided to wear a somewhat elegant tie because Rabbi Thau was very elegant. This shir is Liloy Nishmat Vimori, Sri Benefayim Hakohen, Soprano Levacha, and also Liloy Nishmat Sati, Golda Bas Rechaim Lemo, Soprano Levacha. So in my position as the Abezdin, Chief Rabbinical Judge of the Chicago Rabbinical Council, what's unique about the Chicago Rabbinical Council is that the Beis Din really is three different types of organizations rolled up into one. It's like the Beis Din of America that we have in New York, but it's also like the Rabbinical Council of America, and it's also like the Orthodox Union. We oversee regular Beis Din activities, including the adjudication of Dine Torah, of arbitration disputes, including the administration of Gittin, and including the supervision of the Geirus matters, conversions to Judaism, like a traditional Beis Din. But we also are a rabbinic membership organization, so rabbis of different communities, particularly around the Midwest, will call us up for guidance, whether it's in terms of assistance with the mikvah, or with an eruv, or with the communal issues that they have to deal with, sometimes very cutting edge communal issues that require guidance and direction. And we also oversee and supervise the kashrus activities and policies of the Chicago Rabbinical Council as well. Technically, every single kashrus decision, which means any kashrus decision that the kashrus administrator decides that it's politically expedient to bring to my attention, has to be decided by the Beis Din in terms of articulating policy. I say that a little as a joke. Obviously, the kashrus administrator is very responsible for the CRC, it goes without saying. But I thought that tonight, given the multifaceted role of the Chicago Rabbinical Council Beis Din, that I would speak about some of the issues that confront a modern-day rabbinical court, particularly through the lens of my own experience, and to address how one of the major functions of the Beis Din is to deal with changes in society, changes in societal morality, and the changes in technology. Sometimes I have the exclusive of hosting various college students that will come and visit the Beis Din. Usually it's on a Sunday. Usually they are brought by the local Chabad rabbi who is stationed in their various universities. And usually the students are not particularly from or that knowledgeable in terms of their background. But I try to give them some sort of an orientation into the contemporary relevance and importance of this institution of Beis Din that to many of them appears like a throwback to the days of Moshe Rabbeinu and Yisro, and not something that they ever would have realized still exists. So I point usually to the slogan, to the phrase that is emblazoned on the wall behind the judge's bench in the Beis Din, and we have three words, and those three words are tzedek, tzedek, tzedok. And usually I ask if anybody's able to read it, anybody's able to explain it, and then I ask the question, why is it that we have that word tzedek, righteousness, justice, why is it repeated? The Torah is not just made up of catchy slogans. The Torah is meticulous about every single word that appears. So why would this word, tzedek, justice, be repeated? Why does it appear twice? And I say any answer you give is a good answer, because find somebody who says something of the sort, or that I'll be able to reinterpret or explain what you said to fit into somebody's commentary. But I point specifically to the statement in the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Lamed Beis, Amud Beis, that it stands for Holech HaKabez in Yafeh, that it stands for the notion that it's not just enough to put out a shingle and say that you're a Beis Din. You have to be a Beis Din Yafeh. You have to be a good Beis Din. You have to make sure that you really are responsive to the needs of the community. And I explain that I think that's really what Yafeh means. A good, nice Beis Din means one that is Me'urvim Abrios, one where people feel that the Beis Din understands them and understands where they are coming from. And I point to another comment that the Gemara makes about the repetition of the word tzedek, and that is, the Gemara says, Echad the Din, ve'echad the Peshara. The one appearance of the word is for the strict application of Torah law, and the other is for Peshara, compromise. Now this is, of course, in the context of monetary disputes between different individuals who come in front of the Beis Din, but I explain that it's a general orientation as well, that we have to have fidelity to the Torah law, to the strict requirements of halacha, but we also have to be able to relate to individuals who come before us with a sense of pshara, with a sense of a kindness and a compassion and understanding of their unique circumstances. And it's really in that spirit that I try to approach some of the complicated societal issues that we'll be discussing today. My predecessor in the Beis Din, and the person who's still the Rosh Beis Din, Rabbi Gedaliah Dov Schwartzlita, who still serves as the Abbez Din of the Bet Din of America, he should have a refuah shlema. So Rabbi Schwartz always says that 90% of serving as a dayan is human relations. 90% is having a rapport with the people and an understanding and appreciation of where they are coming from. And this is especially true when dealing with contemporary issues. There was a Jewish press column that many of you probably grew up with, I know that I did, that was called I Remember When. But you remember that when you used to open up the Jewish press every single week, there'd be a column by Arnold Fine called I Remember When. And a regular refrain in that column would be speaking about growing up in the Lower East Side in the 1930s or so. So a regular refrain was, Shoyin, it's a different world. You'd always say that. It's so different now. Whenever he was writing, the 1970s, 1980s, things have changed so dramatically, it's difficult to even relate to how we used to grow up in the 1930s. If you would just compare our world today with the world that he was writing about that was so dramatically different in the 1980s, you would have to exponentially multiply the distinction by probably about a million times. It's not only a different world, it's a different universe, different cosmos, different solar system entirely from what it was that we were growing up with. And yet, halakha has to be the guiding force. Regardless of all of the changes that occur, what's important for us to always appreciate and recognize and affirm is that we are capable, through the prism of halakha, of dealing with all of the cataclysmic changes that we see in front of our eyes. So one issue is the world of LGBT, I suppose that you can call it. The paradigm that I'm focusing upon is the Shiloh that now presents itself to us, which we never would have dreamt about decades ago. Can a transgender person convert to Judaism? When I was sitting down with Rabbi Schwartz Shlita 5 years ago, he showed me some shaila that he had received from a different country about how to deal with transgender people in the community. And he turned to me in all honesty and he said, they didn't really prepare me for this in yeshiva. That it's not even something that was remotely on the radar. And we have to figure out how do we address ourselves given the realities of what's in the Torah. Now we know the Torah says, Ve'ezachar o'sishkar mishkevei isha toivahi. We know that homosexual relationships are prohibited by the Torah. And we've struggled. We've struggled, quite honestly, in the last number of years. I had to deal with this when I was the dean at the Yeshiva University Rabbinical School in a somewhat public way with these tensions. And I remember consulting with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zatzal at the time, and Rav Aaron telling me, huh, you ain't seen nothing yet. If you think that it's bad now, it's just going to get even more difficult in the years to come. And I think he was correct about that. So we've struggled with, of course, our responsibility to reinforce the eternal nature of the Torah's prohibitions, while at the same time demonstrating sensitivity towards people who really struggle with these issues, because you can't deny people their emotions, you can't deny them their humanity. Every single person, if they have a different orientation, a different feeling, you can't be nasty and insensitive to them. You have to figure out how to balance sensitivity and compassion with the absolute truth of the Torah. And it's become even more challenging in recent years when in America, we never would have dreamt of this. I never would have dreamt of this when I was a child, that there would be a Supreme Court case that actually ruled that there is a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. I used to always point to the Gemara in Chulin that says that the Umos HaOlam, the nations of the world, have not been so good at keeping even the 7 mitzvos that they were supposed to keep in many, many cases, but they were always good about 3 things. One is that they always respected the Bible on some fundamental level. Second is that they never sold human flesh in the marketplace. And the third is that they don't write marriage contracts for same-sex couples. So I worried a little bit about what this means in terms of a general societal perspective. The name of that Supreme Court case was Obergefell versus Hodges. And I'm not proficient in Yiddish, but if there would be a Yiddish word for all of this, it would be Obergefell. Like, it's all Obergefell. It's like over and finished. And the world that we knew in terms of the morality of yesteryear is simply gone and forgotten. It's Obergefell. And the question is that given this change, how exactly do we deal with individuals who may have an orientation of this sort in a world that is certainly much more embracing of it, shall we say, and explain and apply the halakha under these circumstances? We have a network of conversion courts in North America. It's called the GPS. I think that maybe we've spoken about it in the past. And every single year we have a conference of the Dayanim from all the different Bati Din, and we have different speakers who speak about some of the challenges that we deal with in the Beis Din. And in two different years, we had speakers who came to us to speak about what if somebody who identifies as homosexual, has a homosexual orientation, wants to convert to Judaism? How do you deal with such a candidate? And then, after that became kind of yesterday's headlines, we dealt during the question of what do you do with transgender candidates who wish to convert to Judaism? What is the approach of the halacha under those circumstances? In the transgender realm, there are two different possible scenarios, and we've really dealt with both of them. One is somebody who has already, I believe the word is transition, somebody has transitioned from being a male to becoming a female, or from being a female to becoming a male, and in their new state. I think if somebody's a trans male, it means they started as a female, they're now a male. If somebody's a trans female, they started as a male, they're now a female. They want to convert to Judaism, and they say, we're going to keep, we believe in the Torah, and we want to keep basically or approximately all of the Torah. And then you have your second case, which is somebody who transitioned, and then they transitioned back, except after all of the operations that a person who transitions completely and surgically to the other gender, you can't really successfully or fully transition back. You have a man, for example, who had operations to rid himself of the outward signs of being a male. They can't really be replaced afterwards. So what do you do under those circumstances? Let's say somebody is simply not capable. We have a male who was born a male, he transitioned to be a female, now he's a male again, not really capable of having a bris milah, which is an essential part of conversion. What do you do under those circumstances? Would a person be able to convert? Now, in the homosexual context, there is always the question of whether a person simply has the orientation or whether they want to continue living a lifestyle in which they're engaged in homosexual relations. They want to engage in that type of a lifestyle, so then it becomes chutz midavar echad, that there's a halacha based on the Gemara in Bechoris Daf Lamed, that if a person says they're going to accept kol haTorah kula, they're going to accept the entirety of the Torah, with one exception, there's one mitzvah that they're not going to keep, then you can't accept them as a convert. This is the reason why most poskim explain you can't accept a woman to convert to Judaism if she wants to marry a Kohen. Because a Kohen, a man who's a Kohen, is not allowed to marry a Gioris. It's a prohibition for the man to marry the convert, the Kohen to marry the convert. It's generally understood it's going to be a prohibition in the other direction as well for the converted woman to marry a Kohen. If a woman converts, she's already married, shall we say, to a Jewish man who's a Kohen, wants to remain with him. It's clear she's going to remain with him. So Moshe Feinstein writes, maybe it's Geisek, Alevi Herzog had written the same thing, that it's simply impossible to accept the convert, not because we don't have an appreciation for the person's desire to be Jewish, but basically this is a situation of chutz midaber echad, where the person says they'll accept the entirety of the Torah, but this is one mitzvah that they're going in their entire life, every single day, is going to be premised upon a violation of this mitzvah. This is different from a person who converts and says, I don't know if I'm always going to remember to say Borei Nefashos. So their life is not going to be premised upon a failure to say Borei Nefashos. We generally work with the assumption that yes, they're going to remember to say Borei Nefashos every single time. But if they forget on one occasion, we're probably not, I'm not guaranteeing it, but we're probably not going to revoke their conversion. This case is different because this is a person who is going in with the full intention, the chatzchila, to begin with, that they're simply not going to keep this mitzvah, that they're going to constantly, every day of their lives, violate this prohibition of being a convert, a converted woman, who's living with, who's married to a kohen. So therefore, that becomes out of the question. But what about a person has a homosexual orientation? So if they say that they're planning to engage in homosexual relations, that also becomes chutz midaber echad, even if it's based on just not being able to control themselves, being in a really objectively difficult position. From a psychological and emotional orientation, not to be able to be with somebody, not to be able to experience intimacy based on their orientation, you have to have rachmanus. But the reality is that at the end of the day, if they say that they're going to engage in these relations and not try to abstain from it, so that's a chutz midaber echad situation, and we couldn't accept a convert like that. But let's say a person simply has the orientation. They have the orientation. They say that they're going to try to remain celibate their entire life. Very difficult thing. They're going to try to remain celibate their entire life because they believe in the Torah and they want to accept Kula Torah Kula. So we actually really discuss this, and we examined this issue, and we brought in psychologists to speak with the Dayanim to see how healthy a process that is, or whether this is something that really could be countenanced. It's very interesting is that the first year, I think it was my first year as dean at Yeshiva, we have different contemporary halakha classes, and I brought in, at that point in time, Rabbi Lamb, Shlita was still serving as the Rosh HaYeshiva at YU. He was still coming into the office every single day. And he had written on the issue of homosexuality and halakha. Of course, it's prohibited, but how do you deal with homosexuals? You have to be sensitive to what they're going through, and maybe they're considered to be an anus, he wrote, in terms of trying to overcome their own feelings and their own emotions. So that maybe you can't necessarily view them as people who are rejecting Torah. So he wrote on this, and he wrote, as he always did, very elegantly and eloquently. So I thought he would be a good speaker to address our students in the modern age in terms of how to deal with homosexuality and halakha. So he gave that one contemporary halakha course. And somebody asked him a question, and they said, Rabbi Lamb, let's say you have a conversion candidate who has a homosexual orientation. Can you work with that person if they say that they're going to try to overcome that orientation in terms of their actual lifestyle? And I didn't really know what he was going to say, but I was surprised a little bit by his answer. Rabbi Lamb said, and this was spur of the moment, and it doesn't have to be the official position of the Lamb family per se, but I'm just telling you what he said at that moment in time. Rabbi Lamb said, I don't think that you should accept such a candidate because I don't think that it's realistic that such a person would really be able to keep to that commitment. And that's not the official position, by the way, of the GPS. The official position, if there is one, I would say it's an official position, but the general policy is that if a person is struggling with some type of a desire to do any kind of avera, but they say that they're going to do their best to overcome that desire, and they're not committed to a relationship where they're going to clearly be violating an avera or a prohibited relationship every single day, then we will work with that individual. But I can tell you, it's not necessarily such a simple thing, and I'll give you an analogy. And it's not a perfect analogy, but just to give you a sense of how you interact and interface, again, in a sensitive and respect and respectful way with such a candidate. Let's say that I have a candidate who has a non-Jew who wants to convert, either male or female, who has a Jewish boyfriend or girlfriend, meaning a female who has a Jewish boyfriend, the male who has a Jewish girlfriend. Technically speaking, you're not supposed to accept somebody as a candidate if it's l'shem ishus, if they're only converting for the sake of marrying a Jewish person. But already, Tosfos writes that if you know that it's sofo lasos l'shem shemayim, at the end of the day, the person is going to convert because they really want to be Jewish independent of their relationship with their Jewish boyfriend or girlfriend. So then you can accept such a candidate, you can work with them, because ultimately they are converting with sincere motivations. And in fact, we have a number of converts, many converts over the years, who have converted after first being in a relationship of this sort, who ended up bringing back the Jewish partner in the relationship to be a full-fledged Baal Tshuva, Baalas Tshuva, because of the tremendous fervor and sincerity and zeal and commitment of the candidate. This has happened many, many times. But at the beginning of the process, you have to ask a question of this candidate. And the question you have to ask is, would you convert to Judaism even if your Jewish boyfriend or girlfriend wasn't in the picture? Even if you would break up tomorrow, would you still have the same fervent desire to convert to Judaism? And you know what? The answer is always yes. And I realize at a certain point in time, they know what the answer is. It's not like there are two different possibilities in terms of what they're going to say to me. But how do I know that the answer is really sincere? Obviously, time will tell in terms of their steadfastness, in terms of their level of remaining observant, their level of knowledge, of integrating into the community, of integrating all the material that they have to learn. So we figure time will tell. But the truth is, we're setting people up on a certain level, and now I actually say that explicitly. I say, I'm going to ask you this question, and I know what the answer is ahead of time. Both of us know what the answer has to be. But I want you to explain to me why I should believe you. At least I make it a little bit stronger. I was visiting the Beis Din in Yerushalayim. One of my friends is one of the Dayanim of the Beis Din Megir of Yerushalayim. I was visiting there a couple of years ago, and I was really impressed by something that I witnessed, which is that there was a woman who had a Jewish boyfriend, and she was going through the conversion process. And the Beis Din asked the same question of this woman. They asked her in Hebrew, obviously. They asked her, would you be converting even if this fellow wasn't in the picture and you wouldn't be marrying him? And she answers such refreshing candor. She said, why? I want to build a nice family, and I met this fellow, and I'm prepared to go along with his value system because I think it's beautiful. I see, you know, how his own family gets along with each other, and I want to marry him and build a family according to those values. But of course, if I'd be going out with somebody from a different religion, so then I would be following that religion. And I turned to my friend at the time and said, well, I never heard anybody answer with such refreshing candor. And I said, so what are you going to do now that she gave this answer? And he said, well, it looks like a pretty strong relationship, so my guess is that it'll probably work out, and she'll end up having a full-fledged commitment, so we're going to continue to work with her. So it didn't automatically disqualify her, but it was nice in a way that she felt the safety that she could give an honest answer for where she was holding, again, at that point in time. She'd still be holding at that point at the conclusion of the conversion process. My hope is that they wouldn't convert her, but at least at that point in time, she gave what was an honest answer. So I have this dilemma. I really have this dilemma. I'm sharing with you a dilemma in terms of how we deal with these issues nowadays. And the dilemma is, that if you ask a candidate who has confessed to the fact that they have a certain orientation, they have a homosexual orientation, same-sex attraction, and so forth, and you say to them that in that order for the conversion to be countenance, to be allowed, they would have to overcome that orientation for the rest of their lives, and you say to them, are you come that orientation to not being in this type of a prohibited Torah relationship, so they also kind of know what the answer is. And what Rabbi Lam was suggesting, and I'm not saying that this has to be borne out, but what he was suggesting was maybe even consistent with his compassionate approach of calling somebody who's in that position an anus. What he was saying is, how could you have such an expectation for a person to really be able to overcome that orientation in terms of the relationships that they're going to have in life? So you're basically setting them up. You're asking them to give you an answer that's not entirely truthful. Now, I don't know that this is correct. I don't know that this is true, but I do know that in those situations where we have dealt with people who were very honest, and I think appropriately so, in terms of their orientation, and trying to work with them, this has been a challenge. This has been a challenge. That's not a critique of the sincerity of individuals who struggle with this, but it's simply an acknowledgement of how difficult and how complex these types of issues are when you do have to deal with candidates of this sort. It does not in any way remove our obligation to try to work with people when they say that they're going to overcome various challenges, but it does mean that we have to be honest and we have to be understanding and sophisticated about the huge nature of this type of a challenge. So there are similar concerns in the transgender context. I'm not going to give a shiur right now about whether it's permitted, according to halacha, to become a transgender, because basically 99% of the poskim say very clearly that, of course, it's prohibited. Somebody wrote a sefer called Dor Tapuchot about 15 years ago or so, where he outlines all the various prohibitions, including the prohibition against castration, the prohibition of lo yekli geber al isha, lo yibash geber simlas isha, beged ish and beged isha, cross-dressing, including issur chabalah, of causing a wound to one's body, etc. A number of different prohibitions that are involved in making the transition from one gender to another gender. I was once interviewed by a high school newspaper in California. I think it's called Shalhevet. The newspaper is called The Boiling Point. And they had students who were struggling with transgender issues. And they called me up and they wanted a halakhic perspective. So what I said to them was that, look, from a halakhic perspective, just like when you speak about compassion towards people who have homosexual inclinations, you have to be truthful and honest about what the Torah allows and doesn't allow. So too over here, Post can basically say this is not something which is permitted. But there's another dimension of the conversation, which is the human dimension. What I call echad the din ve'echad the pshara, that we have to recognize and embrace and follow the halacha, but at the same time, every single situation requires human sensitivity to just appreciate what a person is going through and to struggle with them. Not to condemn anybody, but to sit down and say, wow, this is a real problem. The Torah says this and you feel the following way. We have to struggle together. We won't necessarily come up with easy answers or solutions, but we have to struggle together. And of course, a question that comes up is what about a person who feels that they need to make the transition for pikuach nefesh purposes in order to save their life? Because otherwise, I think that I read a statistic somewhere that says that 41% of people who go through this transgender dilemma, whether they transition or not, but they just feel this way, they feel like they're a different gender than their outward indications, 41% attempt suicide at least once. So you're dealing with a lot of fragility, and you have to have an appreciation and have a respect for that as well. But I said, we don't change permanent halachos based on these types of considerations. If there is pikuach nefesh, so we have general guidelines. Pikuach nefesh overrides most of the prohibitions of the Torah. It wouldn't override the prohibition against arayos, against forbidden intimate relations, but it does override many other prohibitions. And those are conversations to have on a case-by-case basis to figure out how we would apply those parameters. And those are certainly conversations you can have in individual cases with the Rabbanim. But otherwise, it's prohibited. This is a prohibited act. When I say 99%, it's really 100%. Because I don't really know of anybody who says that it's permitted. There is a discussion about whether it works. Whether if a person went through such a transition, male becomes female becomes male, halakhically, do we say they shouldn't have done it, but now that they did it, we're going to view them in their new state. And maybe their new state doesn't present the same halakhic problems. L'mah davar doma, I'll give another analogy. You have somebody who has a tattoo. According to Torah law, you're not allowed to tattoo your skin. But let's say somebody before they were Jewish, they tattooed their skin, they have a big giant tattoo, now they want to convert. So is that considered to be an impediment to its conversion? So in truth, there's a long tshuva by the Ateres Paz who asks, is the tattoo a chatzitza for going to the mikvah? And he says, once you have a tattoo, it's not a chatzitza. It's far enough into the skin that it doesn't constitute a separation between the body and the water. So therefore, a woman who had to go to the mikvah would be able to go to the mikvah. If somebody wants to convert, they have a tattoo. It is not an impediment to its conversion. So do you say similarly that here it's an avera for somebody to undergo this transition for various reasons, but if they did it, they're not constantly violating the avera every day, they're not castrating themselves every single day, so do you say that we recognize them in their new state? So there's a tshuva by Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, the Tzitz Eliezer, which is a much discussed tshuva. Everybody disagrees with this tshuva, but nonetheless, the Tzitz Eliezer didn't disagree with himself, or maybe he did actually, but the Tzitz Eliezer, at least in one, he has three tshuvos, and they all say different things. But in one of his tshuvas, one of his responsa, he's asked about a man who becomes a woman. Man becomes a woman, does his wife require a get? I assume she wants to get divorced. So does the wife require a get or not under these circumstances? And by the way, there are couples. It's really not so much a laughing matter. There are couples where the couples struggle together about this, where one of the spouses does have these feelings, that they sometimes feel that they want to be the other gender, but they also want to save their marriage. And they work together. And these are real life situations, and these are real people. And it's something that I deal with. And you really have to have tremendous sensitivity. But in the Tzitz Eliezer's case, the person transitioned. It wasn't just that they had the feelings; they actually just turned. A man turned into a woman, and it's a theoretical case. He's not talking about a real life case. And he asks, does the wife require a get? And he brings a raya proof from the Trumas Hadeshin. Trumas Hadeshin asks, what about the wife of Eliyahu HaNavi? Is she allowed to remarry? Her husband never gave her a get. He never died. Just went up in a chariot of fire into the heavens. So is she basically stuck? Is she an aguna? So Trumas Hadeshin says, well, the Torah prohibits a woman from being with another man when she's an Ashes Ish. When she's married, it says Ashes Reyeu. Has to be the wife of somebody else, of another man, somebody, another living human being. But there's no prohibition against being with an Ashes Malach, a woman who's married to an angel. And therefore, Ashes Eliyahu is perfectly permitted. Mephas Klinach says, not sure where he got that from. There's no get, there's no misa, it's a question mark. But that's what the Trumas Hadeshin says. So Tzitz Eliezer says, it's the same thing over here. The Torah prohibits an Ashes Ish, a woman who's married to a man, from remarrying, not an Ashes Isha, not a woman who's married to a woman. So there are those who said, oh, based on this tshuva, the Tzitz Eliezer, it seems that he recognizes the notion of a transitioning. But it's important to recognize that the Tzitz Eliezer, although he makes reference in passing to the fact that he's heard that this was written in 1967,
he's heard that there are some operations nowadays where people actually do something similar. That's not the focus of his tshuva. He's not talking about the people who go through the operations. He's talking about where there was some miraculous event that occurred, like the miraculous event of Eliyahu HaNavi going up into the heavens. There was a miraculous event where this man turned into a woman, turned 100% to a woman, not through operations or anything of that sort, where you can argue how efficacious that is according to halacha. It just was some miraculous event. So I think if you read the tshuva carefully, it's very, very difficult to extrapolate from the tshuva. And furthermore, there's a later tshuva by the Tzitz Eliezer that indicates that he would view this situation as one not where the man became a woman, but where the man is viewed under those circumstances as having a dual gender identity of an androgynous, and if he was still treated as an androgynous, so even according to the Tzitz Eliezer, the wife would not be able to go free without a get. But the reality is that even with respect to this issue of the get, the other poskim, including the Leib Aryeh, Rav Aryeh Grossness, and many other poskim, and Nishmas Avraham writes this, disagreed with the Tzitz Eliezer even in the context of the get situation. We have the question with the get, how do you write the person's name? There was at least one case I know of where there was a transgender person who got divorced the last couple of years, and the Bezdin had to figure out how to write the person's name in the get. Man's divorcing a woman. He used to be known as Daniel, now he's known as Ronit. So what do you write in the get? So the Rabbi Jachter, my friend and colleague, Rabbi Jachter has an article in Tzukumen, you could look it up, in Chelek Chav Gimel of Tzukumen, in which he quotes Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam says that if a person becomes an apostate, so then you don't write in the get the name that they have taken on in their new identity as an apostate, because it's associated with a veira. So he said, since you're not allowed to go through this type of operation, according to halakha, regardless of the sensitivity you might have to a person, so since this name is associated to an identity which came about through a veira, so he says that he thinks that there's a strong argument to be made not to write that name. I did see a tshuva, I looked it up last couple of days, was not able to find it again, but I saw it a couple of years ago from Rav Asher Weiss, not talking about the person themselves, but the person's, the husband's father had become a transgender. He went from, I think, the case I'm giving, I think this was exactly the name change, I think it was from Daniel, or from Daniel to Ronit. And Rav Asher Weiss asked the question, what should you write in the get in terms of the husband's father's name? So he said, since the father goes by Ronit, write Ronit, because that's the name in which he identifies himself. But that's a different case, because that has nothing to do with the husband's level of observance. It just has to do with identifying the husband in terms of people saying, oh yeah, I know this fellow because I know the father, and the father is Ronit. So therefore, and sometimes we'll even write a mother's name in a get as well. So that's a slightly different circumstance, but that's another manifestation of how these different situations affect halakhic normative practice nowadays. So there are discussions in post-gym and differences of opinion about a person who goes through this type of surgery, and this is a shiloh that we get at the Beis Din, sometimes from rabbis in different communities. What sex is it on? So that's an interesting question. Most of the poskim are of the opinion that the person should sit. Yigal Shafran has a tshuva about this also in Tzachumen, I think, Chelek Chav Aleph of Tzachumen, in which he says that the person is still, since the person is still a man, it would be improper for the person to sit in the woman's section. And Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Weinrib quotes from the Sefer Dor Tapukot to say, according to his understanding of the Sefer Dor Tapukot, since the person looks like a woman, should sit in the woman's section because there'll be less of a distraction. And others, like Mordechai Eliyahu, who is quoted as saying that the person should not sit in the men's section or the women's section unless the person tries as best as possible to look like a man. So those are different shilos, Picayune shilos, that are very halacha lemaisa nowadays. But what about in terms of the conversion itself? So here, what you have is, unfortunately, a chus midavar echa type of situation. And this, you'll find the tshuva about this subject, about a woman who had become a trans male, who then wanted to convert to Judaism. It was a shaila that was sent to the Eretz Chemda Institute. It's in Chelek Hei Simen Pei Zayin of Bemarei HaBazak. And they were presented with a shaila from Sweden. Apparently this happened in Sweden. The Besen over there wanted to know if they could accept this person for conversion. So he said, there are a few problems. You have built-in problems. One built-in problem is that people won't realize that the person who you're converting isn't really a male. And they'll think it's a female, and then it will create yichud problems. It could create arayas problems. It could create that the person will be accepted as an aide, and they'll end up being the aide for a marriage or an aide on a get, and then it'll turn out that the marriage or the get will be invalid. But most importantly, you have a chutz midavar echad problem, which is built in, namely that every single time that the person dresses according and identifies according to the new gender, it's going to be a violation of lo yechli gever alisha, of lo yabash gever simlas isha, that every single day this person who's still male is going to be dressed like, this person who's still female will be dressed as a male, and so too in the opposite direction. So I received a call from a rabbi, I don't know exactly of what denomination, didn't matter to me. I was asked to speak to a rabbi who was a spokesperson on behalf of people who suffer from, I should say, or struggle with transgender emotions, and wanted to know what our policy would be with respect to a transgender who wanted to convert. And I said, look, the truth of the matter is that we love everybody. We have to really have love for all humanity and love for everybody's struggles. I just don't know, and this is what I'm telling you as well, I don't know how to overcome this issue. I really just don't know how to overcome the issue. I said, I could see the possibility if the person started as a man, and they'll say, I'll keep all the mitzvos incumbent upon a man. Or the person started as a woman and said, I'm going to live my life according to the mitzvos that are incumbent upon a woman, and I'll stay away from prohibited relationships that a woman can't engage in, and everything else. And I'll observe, you know, and I won't wear tefillin, and I'll, whatever it is that's appropriate for a woman, and same so too with a man, he will wear tefillin and everything else. But I said, I don't know how to get over the Beged Ish and Beged Isha issue. And that's also one of the 613 mitzvos. I said, if the person goes back to identifying with their initial orientation, which according to halakha is how they are viewed, Rabbi Bleich also writes about this in Contemporary Halakhic Problems. So then I said, maybe we can work with the person, but if they're identifying according to the other gender that they transitioned into, I just don't know how to overcome it. So then this rabbi said to me, but what if it would just really traumatize them and it could really cause them suicidal feelings if they would have to go back to their original gender? So I said, so we wouldn't want to set people up for suicide. We don't want to set people up for that type of thing. I would say just leave it alone. But I'm not going to bring somebody into the fold of Judaism in a way in which they're going to be doomed to become more suicidal in terms of their feelings. So I said, it's really a terrible conundrum. And I'm not closing the door or ending the conversation. I am simply recording the struggles that we as a Beis Din have to deal with, because we have to show our fidelity to Torah. Echad Ladin, even at the same time that Echad Lepshara, we have to have sensitivities and compassion for the human situation. And that's really how I left it. We did have a situation with one person who started it before they had an interest in becoming Jewish. They started as a male, transitioned to a female, decided to go back to becoming a male, decided that that they needed to reconnect with their true original identity, and then afterwards they wanted to convert to Judaism. So I discussed the situation with Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, and we agreed that there's certainly no impediment in that type of case. The only impediment was that we couldn't do a bris milah. So the Shulchan Aruch says that in a situation with nechras hagid, if, God forbid, you have an individual whose apparatus was cut off entirely, so then they convert to Judaism without the need for bris milah. And the interesting analogy is, how do we know the person can convert to Judaism even without a bris milah? Because we have a whole class of people who are able to convert to Judaism without a bris milah, namely women. So here, there is a respect, you know, at least for, if not recognizing them as a woman, respecting the fact that their physical situation is similarly limited or circumscribed in that particular fashion. It gets a little bit more complicated if the apparatus is not completely cut off, but we didn't, you know, we have to get into that per se because it didn't materialize. In that particular case, but at least we were able to come back to the person and say, yes, we can work with you. And that really is the answer that we want. We want to be able to work with people, but of course we have to be able to work with people within the context of Torah laws and Torah boundaries. There's a Sefer Shofar HaPeh by Rabbi Rafael Eifers, who says that one thing he was able to extract from the Tzitz Eliezer. Apparently, the Sefer Dor Tapukot also says he can't really figure out cohesively or coherently all of the different shuvos, the different responsa of the Tzitz Eliezer on the subject. He has one response in which he says, if a little baby is born, on the outside is a female but has the genetic makeup of a male, so then when the child is still a baby, so you can just fix up the child so that the child will be 100% consistent with the outer makeup, which since the child looks like a female on the outside, treat the child as a female and do whatever surgery you need in order to permanently affix that gender status to the child. But that's the only clear-cut modern-day tshuva where he's clearly talking about operations, and that's totally different because there the final gender is the gender that the baby was born appearing as, which was a female. So Rabbi Eifers asked the Tzitz Eliezer in general how one approaches the shailas, and he says she'am ali. Says a Sha'alti SP Harab Hagaod Rabeliezi Yehuda Waldenberg. The Amali says, should we call Malcolm, whatever is the halakhic answer to all these questions? Let's say you're dealing with somebody who was born Jewish who struggles with these issues. And we deal with people like some of the finest, very fine Erlach people, I have to tell you, at least that I've dealt with. Srihin the Kabul the Adis of Chumada Efsha. To keep them in the fold. We don't reject anybody. We don't throw anybody out of our shuls, out of our schools. Somebody who really is struggling, wants to keep Torah, is just struggling with an issue. We figure out, again, on a one-on-one basis, we figure out how to work with them, understanding that we're not going to compromise Torah principles, but we're also not going to compromise our Avos Yisrael. So that's issue number one. Issue number two, probably don't have so much time for as extensive a treatment, but I'll give short treatments of the remaining two issues that we put on the flyer. Rabbi Tao, how much time do I have?
15 minutes
is fine. So second issue is, what did I call it? The Shavuos marijuana cheesecake. So this is an issue that we face, again, as being moral arbiters for the community in the context of a Beis Din that deals with all kinds of different policies, including kashrus policies. One of our jobs that we see as a Beis Din for our region, for our geographical region, is to establish certain rules regarding health and security. So, for example, Rabbi First, who's the dayan of Agudas Yisrael in Chicago, and I joined together to issue a couple of letters just within this past year alone relating to public health and security. So we issued a letter about the halakhic mandate for everybody to receive vaccinations, to receive the mumps and measles and rubella vaccination, that there are no exceptions, and that if you don't vaccinate, our schools are not going to accept you. And that wasn't necessarily the most popular position amongst everybody. It was pretty popular, but unfortunately, as you may know, we have a problem in that regard in certain communities where people have simply lost their minds. So sometimes we just have to restore people to sanity. But we also issued another letter with respect to security in shuls. What are the proper parameters of carrying guns in shuls, of having people with walkie-talkies, We issued a very careful letter that was calibrated only for the Chicago community, because you have to be very careful when you're dealing with the possibility of Zilzul Shabbos, if you're going to institute security measures. So we're very, very careful and very calibrated, and left a lot of discretion to the Rabbanim to be, you know, as machmir as they felt was appropriate for their shuls, given the security concerns that either would exist or would not exist in their particular shuls. But this is also part of what a Bezdin has to deal with in terms of community safety. So this one rabbi in our community came to me and said, what are we going to do about the marijuana issue now that it's becoming legalized in more and more states? It's not legalized yet in Israel. I know that there was one party that ran on that platform. Leave it at that. And it's still something which is technically prohibited. But in America, you have more and more states which have been legalizing recreational marijuana. Illinois is set to legalize recreational marijuana beginning January 1st. And the question is, what do we do about it? What is our halakhic position? This came to our attention a couple of years ago when we were asked about giving certification to medical marijuana. So there's a tshuva by Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote a tshuva back, I think, in the 1970s. It's in Chelek Gimel Siman Lamed Hey of Yoredeya, of the Igros Moshe. Rav Moshe writes that it's prohibited to take marijuana. He did not prohibit to use marijuana. He did not make it dependent upon being prohibited according to civil law. Every reason he gave would be equally applicable even if the secular law would permit marijuana. And he said, reason number one is that the marijuana is intended to blow your mind. And in our Torah lives, we're supposed to have very functional minds, because we need our minds to learn Torah. We need our minds to do mitzvahs. So therefore, he said, any kind of substance that is intended to blow your mind is going to be prohibited. That was explanation number one. Explanation number two, said Rav Moshe Feinstein, the whole purpose of the marijuana is to be goren taiva. It's to feed into your lust and your desires and your yetzahara. So he said, we're supposed to curb our yetzahara. What's the term? Curb your enthusiasm. So we're supposed to curb our yetzahara as much as possible. We're not supposed to build it up. He doesn't bring this as a source, but if you take a look at the Sefer HaChinuch at the end of Parsha Shlach, on the mitzvah, Lo Sasu Acharei Levavchem Acharei Einechem, I'm not straying after your hearts and your minds when it comes to Arias or comes to Avodah Zarah. So he says, the Sefer HaChinuch says, this is applicable to any kind of addictive activity, basically, where you're going to be building up your lust, that you'll have an addiction that you won't be able to control. So that's reason number two. Reason number three, he says, is because you'll then become like a ben sorer umorer, that you'll become so addicted to this type of immoral behavior, that it's going to very possibly lead to crime, as we've seen in many, many situations. Never mind the fact that he assumes there will be a violation of Kibud Av Va'Em, that your parents could probably not be doing the same thing. The only time in my life that I actually had possession of marijuana, and for that matter, cocaine and heroin and all of these things, was really only when my father gave it to me. And the reason why my father, Zichrono Levavcha, gave it to me was because when I was in seventh grade, and obviously could be trusted, I was doing a science project for my biology class. I didn't know what to do, and my father was teaching the drug prevention in the New York City public schools at the time, because he was a principal in the New York City public schools. So he gave me his drug kit. He said, this is great. You could bring this to school and just do a whole demonstration about the perils of different drugs, of marijuana, of heroin and cocaine. So I brought it in. I remember my teacher was looking at it the whole time, his jaw was dropping. But you know, I was an innocent little kid. I gave my presentation. I never opened up the vials. I never took anything. But that was the only time I got it out of my system that I ever had possession of it. Says Rav Moshe, so we generally assume parents don't want their kids to take it, so it ought to be a violation of Kibud Av Va'Em. And then finally he says it's a violation of Kiddoshim to you, that you're not supposed to be a Naval B'Reshus HaTorah, that even if you couldn't find any prohibition, we're supposed to be Kadesh Atzmecha Mimutalach, that you're supposed to sanctify yourself by not engaging in the excesses of the Umos HaOlam, of those who are around you in society, who might not necessarily occupy or seek to occupy that the same level of Kedusha, of holiness. So therefore, we really would not, I think the answer is pretty clear from our perspective, we're not going to give certification to medical marijuana, to regular marijuana. But then the question is, what about medical marijuana? Medical marijuana is a totally different story, because you have people who are very, very sick, and if they're not able to sometimes take things that will relieve them of the pain, these are people with terminal illnesses, so that can cause the pain and the suffering to be much more cumbersome. There, they're not taking it in order to feed their Yetzirah, they're taking it in order to alleviate the pain and the suffering. So our feeling was, that's a totally different story. And a couple of years ago, when the question came to our attention, we said for sure we would be willing to certify medical marijuana. Now it happens, the medical marijuana plants that had been turning to us went out of business for whatever reasons. So we didn't end up doing the certification, but we were theoretically prepared to give the certification. So the question now that has come to our attention is, given that now recreational marijuana is going to be permitted, what's to stop people from utilizing the products? And we're talking about products where there's an extraction of the marijuana oils from the plant, it's a dilution, there's a mixture with other ingredients where there are kosher sensitive ingredients that it really would require a kosher certification, like for marijuana brownies or marijuana cheesecake and things of that sort. So 2 years ago, nobody was, or at least we weren't, as worried about people taking it for recreational purposes, because they might get into trouble with the law if we gave a heksher for medical purposes. But do we say now that we shouldn't even give a heksher for medical purposes, because if we're going to supervise the process for medical purposes, so then people will also use it for recreational purposes? So we've been doing a lot of research on the subject. I sat down and I actually met with somebody who owns a marijuana dispensary, somebody who's a marijuana manufacturer, to just figure out how these things are going to work. We sat down with people who are therapists, who are experts in the effects of marijuana in terms of the addiction, in terms of the harmful effects on the brain. And we've really been doing a lot of research. But the bottom line is that it seems that the same products that would be taken for medical marijuana purposes would be as available to people who would want to take it for recreational marijuana purposes. So then the question is, do you simply refuse to give any hashgacha at all? Because the people who are suffering from terminal illnesses very arguably would be allowed to take some of these products even if they weren't kosher altogether. Or do you say that no, it would give them much more comfort if they knew that what they were taking was kosher, even if there is a side risk that some people might take it who are not permitted to take it. So one possible solution, I haven't figured this out yet, I'm just sharing with you, and so you'll know some of the dilemmas that we deal with nowadays. One possible solution is the egg matzah approach that we're thinking of, basically saying, yeah, this is kosher, but only if you're dying. Only if you're like really, really sick, you know, God willing, every Kaddish Baruch Hu should give everybody a refuah, but only if the person is really, really sick and this is there necessary to alleviate the suffering, only for those purposes would it be permitted. But our hashgacha, our heksher, does not apply to anybody else. So does it work for the egg matzah? I think for the egg matzah, it by and large does work. You give a heksher an egg matzah, and you say this is not for this is only for cholim and zakenim, only for elderly people and sick people, but nobody else is allowed to eat the egg matzah during Pesach if it works. However, with marijuana, there are other passions and desires that come into play. I'm not as convinced that it's going to be as successful, but this is another, you know, issue, very current, raging issue. Last thing, I'm sorry, so one of the questions that they ask is, what's the difference between this and giving a heksher on wine, for example? So the answers that we're really working out, but one major answer is that sometimes it's a mitzvah to drink wine. meaning the Torah never says it's a mitzvah to take marijuana under any circumstances. But sometimes it is a mitzvah even for healthy people. Very often, it's a mitzvah to drink wine. And also we recognize that wine can be beneficial in appropriate doses, and it's something that we've always controlled. It's something that we've always limited and controlled. And yes, there are people who are alcoholics, and that is a problem within the community, but there is a mesorah for drinking wine, and obviously it has to be done responsibly. You could say there's an expression that Chazal have, Ala rishonim anu mitzarim, that we have problems in other areas where maybe we have no choice but to have the problem, but we shouldn't add to the problem when we don't need to add to the problem. So I think I could dress up the answer, you know, a little bit more, but I think fundamentally that's basically the answer. How can we give a hashkach on donuts, you know? Well, donuts aren't nearly as, it's a question, right? They aren't nearly as addictive. In Hanukkah time, it's a mitzvah to eat, right? So there too, sometimes. All right, so the last, you know, issue I'll just run by quickly is the technological advances. So one major technological advance is that we have made enormous strides in terms of reproductive technology. And one thing which is possible now is for a man to have children even after he's no longer alive, because he can take his zera, it can be cryobacked, and then that zera, that he, the sperm that he leaves behind, can then be used to impregnate his widow or potentially somebody else after the man is no longer alive. So this comes up, this actually has come up in chalitza cases that we've had at the Beis Din, because there's a halacha, there's a mitzvah of yibum, man dies without any children, so then the wife is not permitted to remarry anybody else if the man left a brother, unless she either marries the brother, that's called yibum, or does chalitza with the brother, she takes off a shoe from the brother's foot, and that releases her that she's allowed to marry somebody else, the chalitza ceremony. It consists of various parts, that's the main component of the chalitza ceremony. So what if a man left no children when he died, but he left some zera? It's not at all far-fetched, because if the man died without any children, there's a possibility that the couple was struggling to have children, in which case that they were trying reproductive methods of having a child, and when the man would have donated some of his zera for purposes of trying to impregnate his wife. So what if the wife takes some zera after the man dies and now has a child? So does that exempt her from having to go through yibum or chalitza? Let's say that the husband who died left a brother who doesn't want to do chalitza. Nowadays in the Ashkenazi community we only do chalitza, not yibum. Let's say he doesn't want to do chalitza, and then the woman would be anaguna. She says, I have a great idea. I'll take a zera that my late husband left behind and I'll have a child from it. So here we have a major machlokas among the different poskim that Rav Shaul Yisraeli wrote a tshuva on this when it was still mostly a theoretical question. This has now become a practical question. And Rav Shaul Yisraeli said that any child that's born, that's conceived after the husband dies, doesn't count. Doesn't count for these purposes. It's a tshuva by the Noda B'Yehuda, where the woman gave birth 9.5 months after the husband died. And the question was, should we assume that it came from the husband, so that she would be exempt from chalitza or yibum? And his conclusion was, yes, we'll assume it came from the husband. We're saying maybe it took 3 days after, maybe they were together the day that he died, and then it took 3 days for the seed to become fertilized, because after all, she gave birth so late, so maybe it wasn't until 3 days later that it became fertilized, because the Gemara says it could take up until 3 days. So does that count? And then other viewer said that no, that wouldn't count. If it only was 3 days afterwards, that wouldn't be good enough, because we wait 3 months after a man dies to see whether the woman is pregnant, because you can always tell 3 months into the pregnancy whether the woman is pregnant. So he said, really, we should wait 3 months and 3 days. Why don't we wait 3 months and 3 days? Because obviously what happens afterwards, it doesn't count. It's no longer attributed to the late husband, Yibum and Kalim. But the Noda B'Yehuda did not ultimately rely upon this rationale, and he said, nah, chances are the fertilization took place right away, and it's just that the baby tarried a little longer than usual, tarried for 9.5 months, and don't worry about it. But he says that he thinks that Noda B'Yehuda was fundamentally correct, and certainly in a case where the conception didn't take place until a year after the husband died, the process didn't begin at the time that the husband was still alive, so for sure that wouldn't exempt. But Nosson Gestetner disagreed. Says the Torah says, V'lo yimachesh shemo b'Yisrael. the whole idea of doing Yibum Machalitza is that the husband's name should not be erased, and if the husband had a child, even if the child was born 3 years later through his zera, then his name is not erased, and therefore he thought that you would do it. Rabbi Yashiv has the most fascinating shuvah, when she says if there is still zera, so then the wife is considered like a milberis. She's considered like she's pregnant with the zera, because the zera, the sperm, could be used at any point in time to impregnate her. And the halacha is that even if she did chalitza at that point in time, it wouldn't count, because we paskin that if a woman's pregnant when she does chalitza with the brother-in-law, it's not a valid chalitza. So Rav Yashiv basically said the woman is stuck. If there was any zera that was left, that was set aside, the only possible solution would be if the zera would be destroyed, that would probably, if you're going to be concerned about the opinion of Rabbi Yashiv, who clearly held that it would work in terms of being attributed to the husband, but that creates a problem that it would work, for as long as the zera is around, then the woman either has to have a child with the zera, which isn't necessarily encouraged, or would have to have the zera destroyed so that she would be allowed to have chalitza with the brother-in-law. So these are just a small sample of some of the new shilas that have come up, given changes in society, changes in societal morality, changes in technology. And I'll just conclude by saying that, especially during this period of the 3 weeks, it's especially important to recognize that the more complicated the world gets, the harder we have to work to remain connected to our Mesoa, and to make sure that we apply the Torah to every single new contingency and eventuality that arises on the horizon. It says in Eifa Kogot Fea Hisigua Ben HaMitzarim that whenever you run after God, as the Balei Hasidus say, Korodev Ka Hisigua Ben HaMitzarim, that if you run after Rodev Ka, you run in order to try to grasp the truth of God. So this is especially a period of time in which we're given an extra ability to reconnect with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, like we say at the end of Megillah Seifa, Hashiveinu Hashem Elecha Min Hashuva Chadesh Yameinu Kekedem, we should seek always to stay close with the Kodesh Baruch Hu in applying Torah concepts to complicated situations in our complicated world, and may we be successful to address all of our dilemmas in accordance with the Ruach HaTorah, to always do the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and be zocheh to reestablish Be'ashiva Shavtayah Kibarishona, Be'yotzayah Kibatkila, to establish all of the Batei Din of old in all of their glory. Me'era B'yameinu, Amen.
In about 2 minutes or so less, we're going to have Mark in here. But I'd like to request the women in particular, you know, it's not fair. Every week, the men, we have a shir, every month we have a shir, and the women don't come for the Chol Nekugel. Now, I know that maybe you don't want it, but I just want all the women to know that they are invited to attend in the back. Thank you so much for the family. Mary and Reese and family. Yeah. Huh?